So welcome to, I think it's Wednesday, right? Lecture 9, September 28th, 2022, lecture notes, page 80. Who's going to homecoming? Homecoming? Just me? No one else? You and I, three of us are going to homecoming? All right, I'll be over in the corner with the college business wave to me. Homecoming's supposed to be a thing, right? Yeah, all right, just curious. Anyhow, homecoming's coming up. If you want to get involved in student government at this stage of your career, you could apply for the Undergraduate Student Center Student Government Election Commissioner position. Pay $750 for the semester, next semester, and gives you the opportunity for a variety of training, professional development, leadership development, and specialization in marketing, social justice, event planning. So if that's you, of course I'll put this up, as I always do, in the Canvas, but that's available. Homecoming coming up, you might think about going to it. Sales and marketing fair, if you're interested in either sales or marketing, internships maybe, or seeing what the job market looks like, or chatting with people. The sales and marketing fair is a career fair event for students interested in connecting with employers from various industries for sales and marketing related internships and full-time positions. So that's Tuesday, October 4th, 1 to 3 p.m. in the Kent State Student Center, room 218. Often they have a good number of interesting businesses there. We know about Mario Gambelli on the 12th. We know about the Networking for Good on the 21st. We know about the test results. So Mini Test 4 is open on our regular schedule. Closes Saturday, homecoming, at 11:59 p.m. Do not forget to take that. We know it's up on Proctorio. And the second of the optional extra credits closes tonight at 11:59 p.m., either enhancing extra credit through Connect or Packback. Either way, do it, earn extra credit points. So marketing in the news, we've been talking about sustainability as an important concept. So here's how beauty brands can make sustainability chic. The global beauty industry is worth $511 billion, yet even with the threat of climate change looming over everyone, sustainability issues still account for less than 6% of online mentions by beauty brands. So they don't seem to be that responsive at the moment to the issues of social responsibility in that area of marketing. On a hopeful note, that figure is actually a 47% increase over sustainability-related mentions compared to 2021. So there is some growth in marketers' interest in social responsibility and sustainability. The majority of sustainability-related topics, 4 out of 5, relate to packaging. And these conversations predictably see a spike around conservation-themed holidays, like Earth Day, when mentions double to 10% of social chatter. So here's a bit about your media schedule strategy if you're talking about sustainability in this industry. And it's not big brands leading the conversation. 76% of sustainable brands are independently owned, often by passionate founders who serve as the face of their brands. So these are the brand leaders doing passionate things that they like. An example, Carolina Benales, founder of IQ Insights, a research firm, pointed to Rihanna's Fenty Beauty brand, which has been cruelty-free and all-natural from its beginning in 2017. This lends accountability to their message and allows them to be bolder in their sustainability initiatives, which can be implemented faster because of their independent nature. Small businesses can move more quickly than big ones, and follow the passion of their leader, so small business strategy. So 4 lessons for all beauty brands in this area. First, and this is general, avoid greenwashing and unfounded claims. You just say you're sustainable and not, hardly a good way to go. Educate your consumers, pledge clear actions, report on what you do. So create accurate beliefs about your brand. We're talking in our model of consumer behavior, how consumers are coming to understand brands, beliefs about your brand. You help create those, which creates attitudes and intention. Effective communication means explaining how consumers can do their part in this area of sustainability and social responsible action. Amplify sustainability messages with influencer and celebrity endorsements. This is what we would refer to as social influence on consumers in our model that we're going to come back to today. And those can be impactful as well. And then be patient. Earning credibility in an area for your brand does take time. Stay on your mission. Communicate your brand position. So the brand's doing it best based on engagement. This is thousands of followers in each of these social areas. La Bouche Rouge, 96,000 circumference, 18,000. Tata Harper, 364,000. Kajer Weiss, 121,000. And Everyday Humans, 19,000 followers on their platforms dealing with sustainability. So yay them. Spotify, how many people make use of Spotify? Spotify promotes the power of listening with its first French campaign to highlight the importance of listening, be that to others, to music, or the world around you. Audio streaming platform Spotify has released its first brand campaign in France. So we're seeing global marketing. When you think Spotify, do you think France? They're a global marketer, and their campaign theme, featuring the tagline, Écoutez, ça change tout, which translates as listen, it changes everything. The campaign film celebrates the connections made through sound. Let's see if you find this interesting, amusing, attention-getting. J'ai déjà pris le job, au confort tu rages. La tête dans les nuages et les pieds dans la fraise. Y'a des guitares boxées dans le garage. Fais gaffe si ça donne des gros sur des restes. Y'a plus de passeport, l'homme dans les intestins. J'ai craché mes vérités sur la pente. Les villes, la vieille campagne. J'ai TP, maintenant je fais des bookings. Je suis la fierté, du check, c'est même des hits. Y'a du filmé, y'a aussi du stage. J'ai des gimmicks pour un chat, mon pote ça dit. Alors, qui peut me citer une figure de style dans ce morceau ?
So Spotify, using this example of how listening can connect a instructor, a teacher, with his class, and that's just what this says. The 50-second video follows a teacher who surprises those around him, including his family, and listening to rap music, which helps him to then connect with his students. So there's the ad message, listening is important. The video is inspired by many true stories. Rap is one of the most popular genres in France. And we've heard several initiatives around the world of teachers who use hip hop to catch their classroom's attention. We've just told a surprising story based on these remarkable and conclusive experiments that demonstrate the connecting power of music. 20 and 30 second ad edits. We'll run across TV and digital in France until October 10th. So there's a bit about their ad schedule as they get this brand campaign message out. So, yay Spotify. KFC, who likes KFC? Not that many. KFC's delivery campaign is an ode to the messy joy of eating at home. Though many people missed restaurants during the pandemic, there are some aspects of eating at home that dining out just can't replace. Lounging on the couch while watching television and chowing down on a burger, for instance, or standing up at the kitchen counter wearing only a t-shirt and underwear while digging into a bucket of fried chicken. KFC's latest campaign celebrates the everyday indulgences of ordering takeout, the messy, slightly embarrassing, yet glorious moments of eating a comfort meal in the privacy of your own home. The fast food brand is promoting its delivery services as part of its sponsorship of the British broadcaster ITV's coverage of the 2022 FIFA World Cup, which will run from late November until December 18th. KFC UK and Ireland will air these ads I'm about to show you on ITV's TV and digital channels during the live broadcast of the World Cup games and highlights programs. So here's global marketing and, of course, the media strategy. Given you're a sports sponsor, you have access to these channels and to those audiences. Let's see if this strikes you as attention-getting.
You can't have a jacuzzi at KFC. It's not that kind of place. It would be impractical and unhygienic. And that's why there's KFC delivery. Because eating chicken in a jacuzzi is a private matter. You can't put your feet on the table at KFC. It's not polite. That's where people eat. And that's why there's KFC delivery. Because your table is your business. Bring the law. You can't have a lion at KFC. Our chairs are comfortable, but not that comfortable. And that's why there's KFC delivery. Because you can't have a lion on a chair. It's just not possible. You must not remove your trousers at KFC. You'll be ejected, and the police may be called. And that's why there's KFC delivery. Because nobody wants to see you eat chicken in your pants.
So obviously they aren't going to run all of these at one time, but I thought that the four were an amusing view of their ideas. So the four spots created by this ad agency Cupboard captures satisfying scenes behind closed doors after customers receive their KFC deliveries. And one group of men eating fried chicken from a jacuzzi while another two friends are seen with their feet up on the table and their eyes transfixed on the TV, KFC items in hand. KFC delivery customers can also eat their meals while not wearing pants or from the comfort of their beds, as the ad shows. So we've seen a bit about humor in advertising, presumably getting consumers' attention with this campaign, with the music as well. The voiceover explains that these are all things you cannot get away with in an actual restaurant, and that's why there's KFC delivery, so the ad message. Winter is coming. What might that be a pop culture reference to? Game of Thrones, right? When I was in, where was I? Ireland. I did a whole Game of Thrones tour this last summer. It was very exciting. The guy on the bus tour actually was in an extra in one of the series. Winter is coming. Yes, the nights get longer. It's hard to think of anything better than enjoying KFC and the comfort of your own home. And that's what this campaign is all about, doing what you want to do, says their marketing officer. So we're satisfying consumer needs, wants, and desires with our delivery of KFC. Many restaurants, including KFC, have ramped up the delivery and digital services since the pandemic. Early this year, KFC announced that it would trial using delivery-only kitchens in London, with additional trials to take place in other locations later this year. So no walk-in storefront at all. Customers can order from these kitchens using delivery apps such as Deliveroo, Just Eat, and Uber Eats, as well as KFC's own website and app. So we're seeing the continuing impact of the pandemic and a little bit of creating customer convenience by having these sorts of stores. We also hear them called ghost restaurants. There's a storefront, but you can't go into it. They just serve food out of it on order. Take notes on this one. It'll be highly testable. Pick up on notes page 80 and lecture page, or textbook page 135. We're continuing with our understanding of consumer behavior, which we've already pointed out is a fairly elaborate thing to do. We're using a modification of the Engel-Colton-Blackwell model. We've been walking through the psychological influences on consumers and trying to understand those a little bit. And one of the things that I brought up was the idea of subliminal perception, which, as I said, at one time students were really into for some reason, and now apparently it's faded out. Anybody know what the idea of subliminal perception is in advertising? Anybody know what I'm talking about? What the topic means? Nobody from psychology has any clue? Yeah.
It's when you put something in there and don't necessarily show or talk about it.
Well, it's not just that you don't show it or talk about it. It's when it's in there and it goes by so fast that you don't really recognize that you see. Notice that you see it so quiet or at a tone that you can't really hear it. This whole thing was put together as essentially an urban myth a long time ago in a movie theater. Supposedly, they blinked up on the screen, drink Coke, buy popcorn, and supposedly sales of both went up. It's been debunked many, many times. It would be highly unethical to force people to buy things by subtly giving them messages below their threshold of vision, of hearing. That's what subliminal means. And by the way, If it was quiet enough that you couldn't hear it, think how it would be impossible to affect me, because I definitely wouldn't hear anything at all, right? My hearing is much different than your hearing. So it's not a thing. You don't seem very interested in it as a group, but marketers don't embed invisible messages into ads to try to influence you. Now, does that mean there's not some goofball somewhere that doesn't put a cartoon cell in the middle of a Disney movie showing Goofy doing goofy things to somebody he shouldn't be? That could happen, but that's not marketing. That's somebody being a goofball, right? So, however, what we do here, and this gets confused with, is the idea of what I'll phrase as hidden messages, okay? So this is the secret sales pitch And he's making a point here with his hidden message. If you haven't actually looked, this is, I borrowed this from the book. If you haven't actually read the book, though, does anybody see the hidden message in this? Is anybody seeing the hidden message? You're seeing it? You're seeing it? Okay, is anybody seeing the hidden message now? Now? You still aren't seeing the hidden message? How many now see it? First of all, why that's going to make you buy the book, I'm not sure. I know sex sells, but I'm not sure sex sells that book. Second of all, why is it hidden, not subliminal? If it's subliminal, when I do this, whoa, it's gone. It's below my threshold. I can't see it anymore. How many people who saw it can't see it anymore? Once you see it, it's there in your mind. You perceive it. It's, at best, hidden. It's not subliminal, okay? And there was a thing for a while in the glass of whiskey that had an ice cube in it. They poured whiskey in. In the ice cube would be a skull and crossbones. People who drink alcohol have a death wish. What? So that would appeal to them. Or maybe the outline of a naked woman. People who drink whiskey like naked women. What? So that would be hidden at best, not subliminal. Okay? By the way, there's another hidden message here. If you haven't read the book, how many people see the other hidden message here? Yeah, there's another one that presumably he's saying is going to help you want to buy the book. Boom. Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, it's gone. I can't see it anymore. No, wait, I can still see it. So there is some notion in pop culture about this idea of these hidden messages selling product. Go do it in your future career. I'm just not sure it's going to influence a lot of people. And what's more, as I say, it's not subliminal wrong term. It's hidden at best. So consumers perceive marketing stimuli selectively, which we talked about last time mostly. Why? Because each consumer is unique in their combination of their needs, wants, desires, attitudes, experiences, and personal characteristics. So, identical advertisements, identical packages, identical products may be perceived very differently by your consumers. To reinforce the point that I said last time, so it's coming on you, marketer, to test it, to understand it with the relevant target audience and know what they're getting out of it. Because it's not just because it's on the page, they should have gotten it. That doesn't work. Consumers are also influenced in their decision-making process by how risky they perceive the decision to be. So this is the idea of perceived risk, consumers' perception of the riskiness of the purchase. One obvious thing that would make you influence your decision-making, right, is financial risk. How much risk do you run if you buy the wrong house? You ever try to return a house after 10 days? You just don't like it? That's not going to happen. So you spend a lot more time buying a house than you do a candy bar because of the obvious financial risk involved, right? Physical risk can cause you to be more involved in the decision-making process. If you are a bungee jumper, a skydiver, I'm betting you're not going for the low-price bungee jump cord and the low-price parachute. You're more engaged in the thing. There's physical risk involved. That's also, I guess, related to performance risk in this case. So if those products fail, not only are you at physical risk, but their performance risk is pretty significant. So the greater the perception of the performance risk, the more consumers are going to search for information. It's going to influence their process. Psychosocial risk. This is, of course, the idea of other people judging you on your decision. Have you ever thought twice about getting that haircut, buying that shirt, that blouse or whatever? Wonder what others would think of my decision? Anybody ever influenced by that? I tell you a true story, not so much in recent years, but for a very long time, my wife wanted me to get a pierced ear. Now, I know a lot of you guys probably have pierced ears, but hardly any of you guys are as old as me. And hardly any of you guys are in the marketing department at Kent State University. Can you imagine what my colleagues and peers would say to me if I walked in with a big diamond stud? I don't think it would be really, oh, that looks like a good researcher there. So I chose not to get my, despite the fact my wife would have liked me to have one, I decided not to get my ear pierced because I'm a little concerned about how other faculty might evaluate my decision. So psychological risk can influence this as well. So marketers have to understand their consumers' perception of risk and address them. For most of y'all, getting a stud earring probably wouldn't be a big deal, other than maybe the cost of a big diamond stud. But it would not be a huge thing. For other segments of the population, it would be a big thing. What's your audience think? Here's an old version, because I'm pretty sure this industry has moved along, but chemistry.com, first 5 matches free to reduce financial risk.
I vow to never wear a flannel nightgown.
Can you just make that, I vow to never wear a nightgown?
I vow to never be a classic rock DJ.
I promise to embrace your human beatbox.
Isn't it time you found great chemistry with someone? At chemistry.com, we vow to help you find it. Take our personality test and get your first 5 chemistry-inspired matches free. Visit chemistry.com today.
So in the time, this was almost $40 a month, or $81 for 3 months. That's money. What if I got my 5 matches free to see how it worked? Okay, reduce the financial risk for your target audience. Learning is a big topic among business and marketers. Learning involves changes in behavior that results from your observation and experience. And thank goodness you can learn. Otherwise, you'd always buy Colgate and never, ever do anything else. You'd always go to KFC and never do anything else. But you learn different sorts of things. So we talk about different kinds of learning. One kind of learning that we talk about that influences consumers is classical conditioning. Anybody remember from their psychology course what researcher is associated with classical conditioning? What animal is associated with classical conditioning? Yeah. Pavlov and his dogs. Does that ring a bell? No? All right, so Pavlov is a researcher. He's working on learning in animals. And what he does is, to simplify the thing to move along, what he does is he has a dog, and he brings food out to the dog. And when the dog sees the food, it begins to salivate, right? Which dogs would do. It's an automatic, unplanned reaction. The dog doesn't think about, gee, there's food there to eat the food. I have to get my salivatory glands going. It's an automatic reaction. So he brings the food out, and he rings a bell. Food and bell, food and bell, food and bell. What meaning does the dog have for the bell before this experiment goes? If you just ring a bell, what reaction does the dog get? Well, it certainly doesn't salivate. It might jump, but it's not going to salivate. Presently, what he's able to do is ring the bell, and guess what the dog does even though there's no food? It salivates. Holy mackerel, the dog has learned to react to a stimuli that had no meaning, the bell, over time with a particular automatic reaction. In the experimental world, the unconditioned stimulus is the food. The unconditioned response is salivation. And then we take a thing which has no meaning, the bell, and that becomes the conditioned stimulus. And eventually, when we pair up the conditioned stimulus and the unconditioned stimulus, we get the unconditioned response, which is the salivation. So, yeah.
So it's like when Mariah Carey's songs start playing for Christmas at the mall, and everyone gets in that like Christmas spirit and starts buying different.
It certainly could be that sort of learning. It gives you a mood about it, perhaps, and maybe you associate that song with the mood of Christmas, and Christmas makes you want to shop, and it's all interconnected. The point is, it's not voluntary, it's not thoughtful. It's an automatic response, yeah? Marketers, of course, do this. All of those brand images that we have out there, the brand name, I used to be able to use, but it's gotten a negative connotation, the angels for Victoria's Secret. They showed them paired together, and pretty soon we got an automatic response. The Marlboro Cowboy was another bad example. They showed the cigarette and the cowboy, the cigarette and the cowboy. Cigarettes don't have any, well, meaningful meaning. Certainly the Marlboro brand didn't. But cowboys had sort of a macho meaning in our culture, right? That independent macho guy. And pretty soon they paired them together so much you just saw the Marlboro Cowboy. You got connected, and then you saw Marlboro brand. Oh, macho. Does this have anything to do with human behavior? Well, sure. You walk down the path one day, and all of a sudden, out from a bush, rushes a dog, woof, barks at you, and bites you, inflicting grievous pain upon your calf. You go to the hospital. You take shots. Okay? What happens the next time you're walking down the street and you hear a dog bark? You probably don't say, you know, last time a dog barked at me, it rushed out at me, and it bit me. Maybe I should be cautious. What happens? Automatic response. The dog bark has become paired with an automatic thing you want to do. So it occurs in human behavior. It occurs in animal behavior. It also occurs in marketing as we pair unconditioned stimuli, ads, with conditioned responses like Christmas shopping. Here's a joke about Pavlov's dogs. The dark truth about Pavlov's dogs. Bell rings, I get a treat. Bell rings, I get a treat. It went on that way for days. Then out of the blue, the bell rings, and I get nothing at all. Nada. I mean, can you seriously call my attack unprovoked? He went for Pavlov, is the joke. Never mind. Operant conditioning. I don't know. Did my psych person know what researcher or animals happen with operant conditioning? Anybody from psych? We need more liberal arts stuff. So typically, we're talking about B.F. Skinner and his rats. So B.F. Skinner, another psychological researcher studying learning, gets a rat and makes it hungry by not feeding it very well, puts it down into a maze. And in the maze, there's a bar. And when pressed, the bar will release a pellet of food. You drop the rat into the maze. By nature, rats are curious creatures, and this one's a curious, hungry creature. So it scampers around the maze, scampers around, it's looking, it's tapping, and eventually it sees the bar, taps the bar, and gets a food treat. Second time you put that rat in the maze, scampers around, sees the bar, goes right for the bar. By about the third time you put it in the maze, it zip, 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 hits the bar, grabs the food. This is also called operant conditioning, which I may not have put up there, operant conditioning, because the learning occurs from operating in our environment in a trial and error fashion and getting a reward. And then you're likely to do it again if you got a reward. Obviously, you got shocked. He's not going to go tap the bar again. When should you never go grocery shopping? Under what state? When you're hungry. Why? Because you're going to buy everything inside. All right, so you're in the grocery store. You're a little hungry. Did you miss lunch again today? Don't go grocery shopping after class. Go have lunch. So you miss lunch. You're going grocery shopping. And you see an end cap display for kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. I don't know what those are, but you grab a bunch and put them in the cart. And you take them home. And you serve them up to your friends and family. And they are delicious. Where did you get those? What are these things? Holy mackerel! How do you feel at that moment in time? Pretty good about kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. And what happens the next time you go to the store? Pretty sure you probably say, whoa, I need to get some more of the kumquat-flavored ding-dongs. And you bring them home again. And people still love it. Wow, you got those again. Holy mackerel. That would be a case of operant conditioning. You're operating in your environment in a trial and error fashion. Something happens. You get rewarded. Boom, you're likely to do that again. Now, maybe the 15th or 20th time you buy it, people aren't that excited about it. But at least initially, you've gotten a reward. This is a conscious decision, unlike what we see in classical conditioning. People, animals we think, but people think about what they're doing. as they act in their environment. And that's a different kind of learning that occurs. Social learning. We certainly know that human beings, and for that matter, many animals, learn from their social environment. They learn by imitating others. So from a very young age, many infant girls begin to act like women, feminine. Many infant boys like men. Not all, but they learn from a very young age to copy what's going on. This is a classic example for me. It's very old, but I like it because it's really a good example of social learning.
Like father, like son. Information on smoking and heart disease. Ask your heart association.
Think about it. Do you really want your kid copying your habit of smoking, learning from you to go smoke? Think about it. This little comic thing is the idea of family service, and here we have Jeffy yelling at PJ, PJ, stop climbing up on the couch and reading a book and copying me. And of course, what is PJ doing? Sitting on the couch reading a book, copying dad. So social learning, we learn from those around us, from those in our environment, and they influence our decision making as well, right? So that's another thing we have to be aware of. Cognitive learning, that occurs from actually thinking about stuff. So you go out and you review that technology, you review that information on that new EV you're thinking about buying, you review you read the reviews of that restaurant. And you think consciously about what it means. It's making a rational decision based on the information that you have, the beliefs that you form. And so marketers have to be aware of what's more likely here. For our example of operant conditioning, man, all they needed was an end cap with the display on it. People picked it up. For technology, you probably have to provide information for people to make a judgment about. Brand loyalty is something that we would hope that our consumers move to, and of course they learn to be loyal to our brand, however, whatever method they go through to learn it. So consumers can learn to prefer one brand over all others. That's pretty important to marketers. How do your consumers learn to prefer your brand? Cognitive, social, classical, operant. So we want to think about that at our consumer base. Attitudes and beliefs, so based on what consumers have learned from processing information, evaluating alternatives, making a choice, and evaluating the choice, consumers can do a variety of different things. One thing they do is form beliefs about the stores they bought from, the products that they bought, their decision process. Did I do it in the right way? Should I have bought the cheapest one? Should have I bought the highest status one? Was that a good process for me? And they form attitudes, either favorable or unfavorable, about these stores, products, decision processes. So what are the attitudes, the beliefs, but the attitudes your consumers are forming about your store, about your brand, about your product? When attitudes are positive, they influence the consumer's next choice. It's a silly question to ask, but if you've created a positive attitude in the consumer and they're going out to buy again, what are they likely to do? If you created a positive attitude with their experience, what are they likely to do next time? It's too easy to say. Come back and buy again at your store, your brand, your product, right? And the obvious is, well, the other is when attitudes don't exist, they don't know your brand, your brand is new, they don't really have any beliefs about you or attitudes about you. Or when they're negative, they also influence consumers' choice. And of course, if their feeling is negative about your store, your brand, the process they went to, it's unlikely, if they're at all rational, they're going to rush out and do the same thing again. So now you've screwed it up, and they're going to go expand their search, which is not what you were hoping for. So what are your consumers' beliefs and attitudes? So marketers attempt to change unfavorable attitudes using the tools that they have, the four P's of the marketing mix, which are product, price,
promotion,
place. So those are our tools. And if we find that consumers don't have positive attitudes about our store, our product, our brand, we should try to change them in different ways, right? So one thing we might do is try to change beliefs about a brand's characteristics, beliefs about the attributes of the brand. I'm thinking about either taking a vacation to Japan or England. And I know one of the challenges for me would be language. As you would agree, I can barely speak English very well. So how am I going to do in Japan? So where would I be leaning right now? Well, I'd be leaning toward a trip to England, which is not good for the tour companies in Japan. So they know that this is what some people feel, and they say, well, wait a second. Language isn't a problem. Sign up with us, and we will have a guide with you. They'll meet you at the airport. They'll take you to your place. They'll be on the tours with you. They'll help you at the restaurants. Language is just not going to be a problem. Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that. They're changing my belief about the attributes, in this case, of a trip. Could influence my decision-making process. Or they could change the consumer's perception of the importance of the brand's attributes. Where do we envision over the next 5 or 10 years significant economic growth to be? In Europe or in the Pacific Rim? You might argue the Pacific Rim has more opportunity for growth than does Europe. So if you travel to Japan, you can have an experience in the Pacific Rim that would look really good in your job, really good on your resume, and would set you up for the future growth of the world. Wow, didn't think about that. I'm not going to get that in good old England, am I? So we change your perception of the importance of that attribute. Or we add new product attributes. So in jolly old England, you might go to a pub. How exciting for you. In Japan, you might go to a geisha house. You might have lovely servers doing music for you, doing dances, serving you warm sake. You might go to a public bath and have a warm bath before you. Holy mackerel. I don't think they have that in jolly old England. Hadn't even thought of those things. Hadn't even heard of those things. So we can introduce a new set of product attributes. To do what? To influence the beliefs that our consumers have about our brand, the attitudes that they have, and the likelihood that they would purchase our brand. Yeah? So these are some of the things that we could do using our tools to change consumers' attitudes and beliefs. This was true a while ago when body wash was first being introduced to the marketplace. In the day, body wash was a female product. It was a woman product. Men didn't use no body wash. They used, I don't know. I'm trying to think of the really scrubby, rough, scrubby soap. Lava. But they didn't use body wash. So Nivea for Men Active 3 can be used both as a shampoo and a body wash, but also functions as a shave gel for both above and below the neck. Too much information there. Drugstore chain Walgreens featured male grooming in its stores each Saturday in June, dubbing the events Saturdudes to explain to men why a body wash would be something that they would want. Today, we wouldn't think so much of that as being an issue, but it was when they first rolled out the product. Axe Same issue, introduced a shower gel with a risque campaign, quote, how dirty boys get clean, using a little sex to sell. It's now the most popular men's brand with a 7% share of the total body wash market, convincing guys that this was the product that they should use by introducing new attitudes about it. Changing consumers' belief, will this be the next big thing for men? Alpha Male for a more masculine nail polish option. Now, originally, when I showed this slide, I could answer in a pretty good way, no. But as it turns out, I get to put a question mark there. Because I did say that a couple semesters ago, and a guy went back and said, you made me feel bad. Why? He says, I wear men's nail polish. So it is a thing. Some attitudes are changing. How many of you know guys, or yourself, know guys wearing men's nail polish? And how many of you don't? Well, I love it. There must be a third category here. How many can't hear me? All right. So it's begun to grow as a thing, right? So we are beginning to change men's attitudes. Whether or not Alpha Male made it or not, I don't know, because it was a more masculine nail polish, a cosmetic company that claims it's for men and fighters. Is it filling the gap in the market for a male-oriented nail polish? What? You didn't know the market needed a male-oriented nail polish? Well, clearly you were mistaken, because men apparently have very specific nail polish needs that cannot be satisfied by mere normal lady polish. For starters, Alpha Nail is designed by men, worn by warriors. Okay, I can see how a nail polish designed by men would differ dramatically from... it's still just nail polish. At first, I thought the distinction was that the polish was matte, although, of course, regular old ladies' companies make matte polish too. But no, Alpha Nail also has Metallics line, which this fighter is wearing. So, a couple years ago, wasn't really a thing. Attitudes are changing over time. Now, I don't know about this one. This is also a real company. See if attitudes have changed about this one. How about men's lingerie? It's a thing. It's from a company called Mangeré. I won't ask you to put up your hand if you are wearing Mangeré right now, but is this something that's going to catch on in manly America? I see somebody shaking their head no. So here's a problem, question you probably never asked yourself, why don't men wear lingerie? It's one of those topics that, until now, has never really needed addressing, but Mangeré is the actual lingerie brand for men. Is here to change the discourse on gender-specific intimates. Mangeré intends to change the way men think about their underwear and how they look in them, providing a unique collection of lingerie exclusively for men. And again, it's an actual, real live. Wait a second, don't laugh at these guys. Wouldn't you like to see your manly? There you go. You're a manly man in a nice sheer fly contour tights. All right, so that's a different question. How quickly are we going to change the cultural values, beliefs of American men to jump on board that? Maybe in a couple semesters I'll come back and people go, yeah, I'm wearing that. Maybe not. Lifestyles. Your lifestyle influences, well, how you live by definition, and the sorts of products you buy. So these are the individual patterns of living as reflected by what you're interested in, the opinions you have, what you buy, and your activities. We measure your lifestyle with a technique called psychographics. It's a technique of measuring values, attitudes, and lifestyle. I took a picture of this guy outside the Bowman Hall one day. I asked him his permission. But this is sort of his lifestyle. I live, I ride, I am Jeep. He's pronouncing the kind of guy he is. He's a Jeep guy, right? This Vals typology attempts to look at consumers' lifestyles using some psychographic techniques. And what this research has found is that we can divide people in terms of how they live their lives based on their amounts of resources, very low resources, who have a lot, don't have much risk tolerance, they can't afford to lose anything, so they're low innovators, up to the top of folks that have high resources. That's health, that's education, that's money. And they are highly innovative individuals. And then In the more middle ground, you see that we have lifestyles driven by three different primary motivations. Those who are driven by their ideals, those who are driven by a need for achievement, and those who are driven by a need for self-expression as they live their lives. And then the low end of the resource scale, less educated, less wealth, are believers. They are very dogmatic. They know what they believe, and they're going to live their life by those beliefs. Better educated, but still driven by ideals, sort of for the philosophers, the thinkers. Strivers are those people that don't yet have the lifestyle they want. So they are going to have a very high credit card debt. They're going to be, as they try to take on all of the achievement of the achievers. The achievers are those folks who've obviously accomplished things in their life. Makers are those people that express themselves, but in these cases, by doing things themselves. And experiencers are those who express themselves by the experiences that they live. Let's take a look at a commercial that I would say is aimed at makers. Self-expression by doing it. You do it, we make it happen at Lowe's. And you know, if you were wealthier, maybe you would have to pay somebody to do all that good work. But this would be a different form of self-expression. The experiencers might live this life.
They say good things come to those who wait. What do they know? Why wait when you can get the Yamaha motorcycle, ATV, or Yamaha Rhino of your choice right now? The Yamaha Why Wait sales event.
Now, I'm not saying there can't be any crossover in lifestyles, but you can see that this is definitely a different motivational sense than having the excitement of painting your room. These guys do have their own website out here, and it has all the things that we've been chatting about. So, I don't know, let's take a look at their definition. As they talk about strivers, as a consumer group, strivers have low resources and an achievement motivation. Members of this group typically have revolving employment, high temporary unemployment, use video and video games as a form of fantasy, are fun-loving, are imitative, rely heavily on public transportation, are the center of low-status street culture, desire to better their lives but have difficulty in realizing their desires, wear their wealth so they can show that they're somewhat successful. And of course, our friends over in the category of achievers also have an achievement motivation, but members of this group have a me first, my family first attitude, believe money is a source of authority, are committed to family and job, fully scheduled, goal-oriented, hardworking, moderate, act as anchors of the status quo, because they're doing quite well, thank you, are peer-conscious, private, professional, and value technology that provides a productivity boost. So if you pictured your target market as one of those two types, it should speak to you differently in terms of the ads you would run, the words you would use, the themes you would have, the celebrities you would make use of, as you think about those consumers' lifestyle for your target audience. Then there are a series of social-cultural influences on your decision making. These include personal influences, reference group, family, social class, subculture, and culture. So here we are over in this part of the model, culture, subculture, social class, reference group, family. We call these normative influences. So your decision to try a product, how you evaluate a product, your purchase decision, how satisfied you are can be influenced by the attitudes of other people. Have you ever bought that shirt, bought that pair of pants, whatever, thought you were looking pretty good, and have somebody go, what were you thinking? Anybody ever have something like that happen? Did you really feel good after that happened? Or did you say, it was on sale or something, right? When you buy that new car, new to you car, and you drive it up to your friends, you don't want them to say, I heard there's a lot of problems with that particular model. That's not what you want to hear, right? Hey, can I go for a what ride? So whether who's ever been influenced to try a restaurant, a book, a movie, some music by a friend? You wouldn't even try it, perhaps, if they didn't suggest it. So this personal influence can be quite an influence on other consumers. We have a group of people called opinion leaders. Opinion leaders are interpersonal influence for you, who are highly attuned to the media environment for fashion or sports or restaurants or books or movies. And they know what's going on. They know what's hot. They know what's new. And you know they do. And so they're the person you turn to and ask about that new car or ask about that new restaurant or that new movie or that new technology because you know they're well attuned to it. And you value their opinion. Anybody, an opinion leader for anything by any chance? Other people turn to you because you're highly attuned to something? What's that? Probably restaurants that you don't eat at. Yeah. Missing food. So if you're an opinion leader, you are probably influencing other people. And of course, the people that you do influence trust you more than they trust those silly marketers. Obviously, these days, we also have vast opinion leaders online, right, with a group of followers too. And they influence them as well. This is Calvin and Hobbes. Nowadays, says the young boy, ads don't just sell a product, they sell an attitude. Look at this ad. He says to the imaginary tiger, here's a cool guy saying nobody tells him what to do. He does whatever he wants, and he buys this product as a reflection of his independence. The imaginary tiger says, so basically this maverick is urging everyone to express his individuality through conformity and brand name selection, buying the same thing he buys. And the kid says, well, it sounded more defiant the way he said it. So we are influenced by other people. Opinion leaders influence us. Word of mouth is a more generic form of personal influence. This is the idea that you not only talk to people who may be well established in an area, but you also talk to other people, other friends who may chat. So if you're on a website, there may be the influencer and then people chatting among themselves as well, which would be the idea of word of mouth influence in the days of computers. PQ Media says $1.82 billion will be spent by marketers to get people talking about their brand. This leads to the idea, of course, of viral stuff or buzz marketing. And you can actually be a buzz agent to get people talking about products. Get buzzworthy products from your favorite brands. Share your opinion and spread the word about your experiences. You can join up. Here's some participating leading brands in getting buzz agents to talk about their products. It starts in just three easy steps. Tell us about your interests. Get invited to try products perfect for you. Share your experience. I feel that my experience with an item will be more, well, it's going too fast. But the point is all these people who are buzz agents feel that they're giving their honest opinions to other people who will appreciate it. So marketers are giving away free stuff to get people talking about their product. Who are the 10 top influencers in social media? I don't know if this is updated. 2020, probably have to update this, so let's see who we got. Cristiano Ronaldo, yeah. Justin Bieber, yeah. Taylor Swift, Ariana. Selena Gomez, Katy Perry, at least I know these people, Kim Kardashian West, Beyonce, and I don't know Felix as well. Anybody know Felix?
PewDiePie.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, PewDiePie. Yeah, what? And Kylie Jenner, the top people in 2020. These people influence the internet. Followers, send them some product. Get them talking about your product, yeah? So let's think about how this influence works in a network world, but let's start in the old world of broadcast, okay? So how would we get consumers? We know consumers don't buy products they're not aware of. If you don't know about the brand, you're not going to buy it. So how do we get awareness? Well, we do a big, broad sort of thing. We use TV and radio and out-of-door advertising to build awareness about the thing. You guys know the brand KTEL, the liquor brand KTEL, K-E-T-E-L? Doesn't matter then. Then, to get people to think about it, you might use direct mail and brochure. Why? Because you can get a lot more information where they're actually looking at the thing that they're considering. Okay. Then, to get preference for it, you might give them a product test, a trial sample, a trial size. Do a comparison for them against the existing products. Purchase. Well, the action is the in-store purchase. And then how might you build loyalty? Well, maybe you offer them reward points. So come back and buy 10, and we'll give you one free. All of this is still valid, but we have to rethink it in the world of social media. So in the world of social media, how do we get awareness? Well, we use search engine optimization. We create buzz. We put up blogs. How do we get people to consider our product? Maybe we make sure that we show up in their online research, or we have user reviews, that social influence. How do we get preference? Through getting them involved in our social media network, YouTube, making our search local, so when they look for a men's lingerie near me, it pops up locally. Action, well, we can do things like group discounts. How many of you guys have ever used Groupon for something? Groupon? Yeah? Okay. Purchase online or in-store or by mobile. Loyalty, we can get friending from them to us through Facebook or Twitter or email, where we can do customized upselling. And unlike the old days, we didn't really have the idea of advocacy for our brand. You might actually get a consumer who likes you so much that they'll come in and do reviews of you, link to you, like you, and in their own right, create additional social buzz for the brand. Does anybody consider themselves an advocate for any brand out there? You're hooked to their community, you comment, you review stuff, you like their stuff? Hasn't worked that well here, but it's a new way of thinking about this connection in the world of social media. How effective can it be? Philips Sonicare Essence, when they first rolled this product out, they sent a $70 Sonicare Essence toothbrush to 30,000 agents along with coupons for the product. Those 30,000 agents each told an average of 9.4 people about Philips Sonicare Essence. Now, if you're going to use this idea, this way to get your product out and talked about, what had that product better be? If you want people to talk about it, it better be, I know I'm being ambiguous here. Good, thank you. It better be good. You do not want 30,000 agents out there saying this thing really sucks. So you better be sure that's the sort of thing that people will really like. And they did. Those 282,000 people told an average of 4.14 more people about the product. And so for their investment, they got impact from people to people of 1,449,480 people. It ended up, in their estimate, their calculation, representing a $2.5 million sales boost. Does it seem like getting this buzz marketing from these influencers was worthwhile? You bet it did. So the idea of understanding how these folks can connect with others through the element of personal influence. Social media influences in consumers' purchase decisions, whether it's endorsing a skincare product, a luxurious handbag, a new model SUV, or even the latest knitting accessory, there's a digital influencer for virtually every product. How does it work? Well, as we've just been saying, it builds brand awareness. Social media influencers have a solid understanding of the platforms that they use, how to create impactful and engaging content, which can build more awareness for their brand. We'll get into social media marketing much later, but what are some platforms where people might show off things that they bought or made? What's a platform that you know of where you see that sort of thing? Yeah. Facebook is one. Twitter would be another. Yo. YouTube would be another. Etsy. Okay. So there are lots of things that you might go to that you might be aware of. Well, you might find these people posting stuff, and they know it a lot better than than we do, because that's their special platform where they can build awareness for a brand. Strengthen customer relationships. Social media can help to do that. 77% of customers have had relationships with brands for a decade or more. And 61% of loyal customers would make an extra effort to shop their favorite brands, to buy products from their favorite manufacturer. And that sounds right, because many of us do prefer buying the Colgate brand. So it's important to establish a connection with your target market. Consumers are more likely to trust peer recommendations, as they're generally considered more trustworthy, a form of personal influence, than claim in brand ads. And social media influencers can be a very powerful force with their followers. Improve buying decision with unbiased opinions. Social media influencers are great storytellers. They know how to communicate effectively with their audiences. One of the main reasons why consumers trust these influencers is because they can relate to these individuals on a personal level. They know them. They like them. Influencers don't just put up an ad on their feed. They talk about the product in detail, how to use them, if they're value for money, what the consumer should expect. How many of you guys have ever watched an unboxing video for a new product because you wanted to see, well, how they reacted, if they liked it or not, I presume? Basically, influencers cover the most asked questions that consumers generally have about any brand or product, and this can massively boost a brand's reputation and drive their sales. Now, interpersonal reaction to people isn't always necessarily positive. That comes up with you looking at me. So we know that consumers' choices in retail stores are affected by, well, what they see on the racks. But now come in reports that their choices are also affected by how they are seen themselves by other people. In other words, shoppers behave a bit differently in the presence of other people in your store. We all know this a bit from personal experience. You tend to buy differently when you're shopping with a friend than you do when you're rushing through a store alone after work, or maybe when you're shopping with your folks, with your parents. But recent studies go deeper than that, and they include the effects of anonymous other people on consumers' choice. So in that social environment, we're talking about personal influence, but anonymous personal influence. Consumers feel more negative emotions, annoyance, self-conscious, when they're in a retail environment where there are lots of people around them. You ever been in a store where you're so crowded, what you mostly want to do is get out of the store? You don't want to continue shopping there? It's too much. Consumers change their behavior to choose products that might be considered more normatively appropriate, low-fat cookies rather than double-stuffed Oreos, or maybe kumquat-flavored ding-dongs, in a busier store. So other people are watching what you're buying, and if they're really close to you, then you're even more likely to engage in more socially normative appropriate behaviors. Consumers alter their behavior even in the presence of just one other person, maybe a hovering salesperson. Have you ever been in a store where the salesperson is being overly helpful? They won't leave you alone. They're standing over the entire time. Really makes you want to stay, or it makes you want to get out of there, right? It's too much. You know, say hi, ask me if you can help me, and then stand aside while I go look around. Don't hover over me. So where's to sell by? A consumer's choice of product might not be affected by whether they want to actually buy it, but rather by whether anyone is standing around them when they pick it off the shelf or the rack. So hover with care. The right attention can prompt consumer choice, but if your customer feels observed, she may just walk out, not what you were hoping for. Family. We are influenced in our attitudes, our beliefs, our purchase behavior, in part by the family that we're raised in, in part through the process of consumer socialization. This is the process by which people acquire the skills to shop, make decisions, the knowledge about how to do that, and the attitudes necessary to function as consumers. And the family is a key factor in consumer socialization of children. You learn about what products they like, they don't like, how to shop. Should you be frugal? Should you look for the sale? Should you go for luxury? Marketers are aware of this, of course, and they create commercials to target this family influence.
He helped me pour the simple grains of Rice Krispies.
Good.
Help me. They're made with rice.
They're poppy.
Where'd the sound go?
Is it in your tummy?
A gentle grain that's easy for little tummies to digest. And fun to eat. Kellogg's Rice Krispies.
we're teaching our kids to like Kellogg's Rice Krispies. And there was one ad that actually showed an image of mom having her mom give her Rice Krispies, and then she's doing it to the kid, which was even more to the point. How many of you guys buy the same, where you buy your own product, buy the same laundry detergent as your family did, the same dishwashing liquid as your family did? Did you go out and evaluate each one out there and decide which one was best for you? Hell no. Your parents liked it. It's good enough for them. It's good enough for me. I learned a brand preference from what my mom liked, from what my dad liked, right? That can happen, certainly. Anybody's, I'll say, parent, used to be just dad, in the automotive, American automotive industry, Detroit, and said, for example, you buy an American car. Anybody have that sort of background? Okay, would you buy a foreign-made car? No, I've been told, first of all, dad might take me down the corner and talk to me, but dad feels that buying American is the thing to do, and by golly, I believe that's the thing to do too. I've learned to prefer it from my family. Family decision-making can be complex, and in fact, the family can be the consumer. So far, we've been thinking about you buying for you, right, as the individual, and you're buying things that satisfy your needs, wants, and desires to solve your problem. But here we have a situation where it can be much more complex. The whole family could be the consumer. So this decision-making process often involves conflict, often involves compromise. Was your parents' choice of fast food restaurants influenced by what you liked when you were kids? No? Yes? You don't know. Oftentimes, we go where our kids like to go. What about vacation? Where to go? Influenced by the kids? Certainly could be, right? So we don't have unlimited money, so we can't buy all the kids a new car. Maybe there's some compromise going there. So how do consumers resolve the conflict, make compromises, given their situation and your product? A long time ago, Volkswagen had a great ad making this point. They panned across a typical U.S. neighborhood. And in one house that looked pretty much like the house next door, there was mom, dad, two kids, and a dog. And sitting in their driveway was a nice new American car. Nondescript. We didn't know what model it was, but there it was. Then they continued panning. We see virtually the same house. Mom, dad, two kids, and a cat. And sitting in their driveway was a Volkswagen and a new washer and a new dryer and a new sofa. The point, you've got limited money. Why waste it all on that American car? Buy a Volkswagen, have money left over for those other things that you want. Good thought process there, I think. Family life cycle influences our consumers as well. So you start off, we would say, young and single. What do people in general who are young and single spend money on? What do they buy? I don't know anybody who's young and single, do you? You guys got to get out more if you don't know anyone that's young and single. I have an excuse. What do people spend their money on? To the extent you have any money, thank you. Pop-Tarts. Say again? Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts, okay. What else?
Alcohol,
assuming, of course, you're over 21. What else do you spend? So I would say entertainment, personal pleasure. What else? Apparel, how you dress. Maybe stuff that we would say for the mating game, looking nice to other members of the species. Yeah? So they are involved in that sort of stuff. When you're young and married without children, suddenly now you're combining with somebody else, and you might not be as interested in Pop-Tarts. Maybe now you have to up your game to salads. You begin to change the sorts of things you're buying as you become young and married. And if you're young and married with your first set of children, man, things really go crazy. You're buying cribs and diapers and toys and baby clothes and baby food, stuff you don't even know what it is, and yet you're buying it as you transition. Then you transition to middle-aged married with children, middle-aged married without dependent children, the empty nest syndrome, they've already grown up and old, the older married, and then the older unmarried. What gender is the older unmarried likely to be? Why? Female. Why? Women live longer than men. But then you have all these non-traditional flows that also will influence your consumer and how they spend their money. So young and married without children versus young and divorced without children, you might regress back to alcohol and Pop-Tarts. It might change your lifestyle. Middle-aged divorced without children, middle-aged married without children, young and divorced with children. So all of these flows influence how your consumer might think about products and what they're likely to buy.
Hi.
Hey. Leo, up ahead.
That is not probably the most obvious target market you would think of for IKEA, but they've asked themselves, what happens when people have kids, get divorced, and they have to live with that environment? It's a little emotional tug there that you've made the kid who was really nervous going to the new place happy by replicating the bedroom at home and the bedroom in the new place, right? So a very sort of specialized focus on a change in that lifestyle, right? People take on different roles during the family decision-making process. And as you might guess, while I'm really excited to tell you about these roles, I only have 3 minutes left to do it. So let's all go home, and let some of us go to homecoming. Go Flashes!